The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. What comes after austerity? The answer to that one single question is going to define politics right into the foreseeable future. If the financial crisis represents a break with the bad old days of boom and bust, what can replace them? For this programme, Politics Weekly escapes the usual confines of the Guardian office and heads over to the TUC. Here we gathered a range of politicians, economists and philosophers, all with their own ideas about what happens next. We asked them, first of all, to give us one concrete policy that the government could adopt tomorrow.
So I'm Dave Powell, I'm an economics campaigner at Rensselaer. The thing we need to be doing right now is getting on with retrofitting buildings. What fantastic economic opportunity it is, how much employment it can create, how much carbon dioxide it can save, how it can boost the economy. So we need to get on and do that. We're throwing money away. So let's have a major government-funded programme to insulate all homes in the UK. Let's get serious about it.
My name's Duncan Weldon from the TUC. If I was in charge of the UK economy for one day, the quickest way to get it moving would be an immediate stimulus focused around public infrastructure and a temporary cut in VAT.
Right, I'm Hajun Chang from University of Cambridge. If I can be in charge of the British economy for a day, I think the first thing I'll do is to make the banks lend again to productive businesses. It could be through better regulation, could be through using government-owned banks like RBS to lend to businesses or to set up a national investment bank. But banks first have to lend to productive businesses. The second thing I'll do is to commission a major report on the state of the British manufacturing industry. You know, in this country, people don't quite realize how far behind they have fallen. On per capita basis, it's something like the 20th in the world, after even Luxembourg and Iceland. Thirdly, we'll have to implement a major reform of the financial sector. So ban all the complex financial instruments whose safety cannot be vouched. Introduce the new governance system in the corporate sector so that corporate managers could manage with a longer-term point of view. And restrain the excessive pay in the financial sector, not simply because it increases inequality, but at the moment, people in the financial sector rewarded for doing things that are wrong for the rest of the economy.
For many on the left, the great frustration during response to the current crisis has been a failure to adopt the solutions of John Maynard Keynes, the great economist of the 1930s Depression. There's no greater advocate for him than his biographer, Robert Skidelsky, who spoke to The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott. Larry began by asking the crossbench peer whether we can conceive of a future where there is a job for everyone.
Yes, we can. But it doesn't have to be a 40-hour week job for everyone. You could certainly think of full employment, a full employment guarantee by the government, let's say, but the guarantee would be for 25 hours or 30 hours. And of course, that should actually happen because as societies get richer, they should work less. But of course, at the moment, we don't do it that way. A lot of people don't get jobs at all, and yeah. Others, you know, work very hard.
Yeah. So we have half the population working too hard, and half the population not working hard enough.
And of course, if you can have a legislative limit on hours of work. They did that in France. In fact, they've been interfering with hours of work ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You can have a legislative limit, and within that, people. Employers and employees can work out their work sharing arrangements.
We're 5 years into this financial and economic crisis now. It's been a longer period of recovery for the UK than it was in the 1930s. You're the expert on Keynes. What would Keynes be saying now if he was here addressing this TUC after austerity conference? What big things do you think Keynes would say about the current state of the UK and global economy?
Well, I think he was in the recession. He was in the depression. He was focused on how to get out of the depression. Later on, he tried to explain how it had happened. But I think in the depression, he would have just said the government should go on spending to make up for the shortfall in private spending. If the private household sector isn't consuming as much, if the private business sector is investing, the government has to step in to make good the shortfall. That's what he would be saying. And in practical terms, in just logical terms, the program of cuts should be cancelled. The government should incur a bigger and bigger deficit until the private sector recovery is sufficiently embedded that it can then sort of start reducing it. I think that's what he would have said. That's what he did say in 1930.
George Osborne and David Cameron would say that they've got to get to grips with the debt problem and Britain's annual budget deficits. Without getting to grips with them, you can't actually have sustained growth. Would you disagree with that?
Yeah, you can't get to grips with them without sustained growth. They're not, you know, you're not going to get rid of the problem, because after all, government debt, as it's thought of, is simply a ratio between what the government owes and the size of the national economy. And if the size of the national economy is shrinking, as we now are in a double-dip recession, government debt, other things being equal, will just grow. So you're not going to get the problem, you're not going to get rid of the problem.
So Keynes would say this is a growth and employment problem rather than a debt problem, and that you need to tackle that the first before you get to grips with the second.
Look after unemployment and the budget will look after itself, was one of his remarks. Now, it's not quite true. I mean, and he understood that there were confidence factors and there were bond markets around at that time. And currencies were attacked, and Britain had to devalue the pound in 1931. He understood that, but he was clear about the logic of the thing. You don't get out of a hole by digging deeper.
Does it make a difference? So you say that they had bond markets back in the 1930s, which obviously they did, but does the sort of complexity and the size, the sheer scale of global financial markets make the traditional Keynesian solution more difficult, the idea that you just allow budget deficits to increase during the depression until the economy grows again? Does that complicate matters, or should it be an impediment to a Keynesian solution to this crisis?
It depends very much where you're located and how big the size of your economy is. It doesn't make any difference to the Americans. There it's a purely internal matter. It makes some difference to Britain because it's so closely connected with Europe and what's going on in Europe, and it makes a hell of a lot of difference to Greece and countries which have borrowed extensively in foreign currencies. So I think people are differently situated, but what's required is, of course, a united European attack on the bond markets, actually, and they've got to decide on a policy, and then the bond markets will be helpless if they're all agreed to have an expansionary policy rather than a cutting down policy. There's nothing the bond markets can do about it.
Yeah. How worried are you about what's going on in Europe? Because obviously this threatens to become a new phase of this crisis. We've had the sort of private sector debt crisis, which sparked the whole thing off, and it now seems to have moved into becoming a sovereign debt crisis, a country by country crisis. How serious a problem is it, what's going on in Europe, do you think?
Well, it is very, very serious because the debt, the government, sovereign debt problem is worsening, and because of the contagion from one economy to another. I think the root of it is that there's no growth, therefore the debt reduction policies of the different governments are not credible, and therefore they're always being attacked. I personally think that Greece should leave the Eurozone, not will it leave the Eurozone. I think it should leave the
Eurozone. Should be made to leave the Eurozone?
Should be made to leave the Eurozone. It would be good for Greece. And it would also make it easier to have a stimulatory policy in the rest of the Eurozone. Because at the moment, the excuse is, well, you know, you've got to have very, very severe financial discipline everywhere. Look at Greece. If you don't have to look at Greece any longer, then I think you can. There's more flexibility, more spaces opened up for fiscal and monetary policy within the Eurozone. And I think it would be good for Greece. It would get a devaluation, which would make it more competitive, and it would be a way by which it could default on its debts.
Let's turn to some of the supply side measures for the UK, because just reflating the economy, getting demand back up is one part of it, but clearly the economy before 2007 had some quite serious structural problems. What sort of measures do you think should be implemented to tackle some of those imbalances or defects in the economy?
Yeah, well, this again, there's a parallel from the 1930s. I mean, when the recovery started, people didn't just go back to the old jobs that they lost in the Depression. There was a new economy built in the 1930s based on mass consumption and...
Light engineering.
And there's got to be a sort of new economy today. So it's not just a demand problem, it's a supply problem. And I mean, so people think about rebalancing the economy.
Is there a problem there with the skills profile of the UK economy? You wander around central London, walk into Starbucks or Pret a Manger, and you'll see invariably be served by someone who's from Eastern Europe or from a non-British background. And you just wonder why it is that with 1 million people under 25 out of work, that young British-born people aren't getting these jobs. Is that an indictment of our educational system?
Yeah, of course it's an indictment of our educational system. I mean, maybe an indictment of a British character, but I don't think that's right. I think it's an indictment of our education system. I mean, I think over the last 30, 40 years, successive governments have fucked up our educational system. They really have. It's exactly the word I would use. I don't use it normally. Precisely describes what's happened. And the result is a very low expectation educational system, which does not actually improve on home circumstances of the less privileged. It actually confirms them. And unless there's big investment in that, teachers ought to be paid much more. They ought to be paid as much as bankers. They're much more important than bankers.
The chance would be a fine thing. Okay, let's start finally. Are we going to get out of this crisis? How long is it going to take? And what's Britain going to look like 10 years, 15 years down the road?
We will get out of the crisis. We always recover from recessions. We never bounce along the bottom forever. Capital equipment will wear out. There'll be some stimulus to investment again, and the debts will be written down, and people will start spending again. So we will get out of it. But whether we'll get out of it towards a complete recovery. Is much more dubious. I don't know what a complete recovery means at this point, given the fact that our economy was probably unsustainable.
Well, I suppose if a complete recovery means sort of mopping up some of the spare capacity in the economy, or all of it, getting unemployment down to 4 or 5% of the workforce, then that would be considered to be a full recovery. Do you think?
But these hard men deny there's any spare capacity. But that's nonsense. That's insane. Of course, there's spare capacity. But secondly, getting a sustainable recovery in the sense that you won't slip back again, because if you don't make the economy structurally more robust, and in fact the world economy structurally more robust, there's always going to be a succession of these crises. So you've got to deal with the maldistribution of consumption, you've got to have a more balanced investment portfolio, and you've got to have much better education.
Robert Skidelsky there, talking to Larry Elliott. Now, one of the realities of a low-growth economy is the exposure of stark inequalities. As budgets are squeezed and services cut, those at the bottom can become ever more detached from those in the middle. Those at the top, meanwhile, appear to be living almost entirely separately from everyone else and forgetting all about it. It's a problem for politicians and for sociologists, but is it also a problem for economists? I spoke to Nicola Smith of the TUC and the American economist Dean Baker.
Starting with you, Nicola Smith, do we really know that inequality's got worse? People have always said that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
Well, we know that levels of inequality in the UK now are comparable with those that we saw at the time of the Industrial Revolution. So the share of income going to those at the very top is higher than it's really been in most people's living memory. And that's a trend that got worse over the recession, when incomes of the very top 1 or 2% continued to rocket, while the majority of the population, and particularly those at the bottom, saw their real wages, that's the value of their take-home pay after inflation, fall or stagnate. We know that government tax policy isn't making things any better. New figures out recently recently have shown us that the share of income paid, for example, by those in the bottom quintile, the share of their income in indirect taxation is around 31%. That's up 3 percentage points on the year. That compares to only around 12 or 13% for those in the top quintile in the UK. So not only are those at the bottom getting less, they're also seeing a higher proportion of their income being taken away in indirect taxation. That will be the VAT rise.
So we might be in something of a new gilded age, Dean, with rich people doing very well and the rest of us not doing so well. You can see why people on lower pay and bishops might care about that, but why should economists care?
Well, not only is that bad for most of the population, but it's also just bad for the overall growth. We've had much less stability in this sort of environment. If you go back to the period after World War II, the 3 decades after World War II, I'm speaking largely the U.S., but I think it's a similar story in the U.K. as well. You had 3 decades of very good growth in which the gains from growth were broadly shared. So workers up and down the income ladder shared in that, and that was in a sense self-sustaining. So what would happen is workers would get higher wages, they would go out and spend more. That caused firms to see increases in demand. They would then invest more, had higher productivity, and this was this virtuous circle. That broke down with the changes in the 80s when most workers were no longer, at least could not count on sharing in the gains of productivity growth. And that really opened up the door for the sort of bubble economy that we've had in the 80s, 90s, and the last decade, which, as we see, has very serious problems in terms of instability. So both in terms of, you know, what we might think of the goal as economy, we want to see everyone gain, not just a small group of people. I mean, that's the point of the economy. And secondly, we do care about stability. And, you know, we all know we brought the economy to the brink of collapse back in 08. I don't think anyone in their right mind could want to see that again.
Could you just recap for us, though, because there used to be this argument, didn't there, in the 80s, the Thatcher-Reagan argument, trickle-down economics, give to those that have, and they're the ones who've actually got the luxury of the time to invest. They've got, they don't have to spend all their money, and so they might actually invest it productively. How did that work out?
Well, you know, what's amazing is we've had ample opportunity to test this, and it doesn't work. I mean, we saw actually a big fall-off, looking again at the U.S., but a similar story in the U.K. We saw a fall-off investment in the 80s. There's no evidence to support this case that somehow if we cut rich people's taxes that they're going to reward us with a lot more investment. The world just doesn't work that way. Firms, their main determinant of investment is the rate of demand growth. If their workers are getting pay increases, they're going out and spending it. They're seeing growth in demand. That's what's going to cause them to invest. We saw a big fall off in investment precisely because that wasn't happening in the 80s.
Okay, so we know that then for 40 years or so, wage growth has been pretty low for the typical American. For Britain, I think it's more like a dozen years. But what, Nicola, do you think any government could actually do? After all, it's easy to say we should all pay ourselves more.
Absolutely, and there's no easy magic solution to this issue, but there's a whole range of policy prescriptions that, taken together, I do believe could have a significant impact. Let's start with pay at the very top. That's a recent debate in the UK about how we can reduce rewards for the very top executives. There's been a lot of focus on the role of shareholders in doing that. We agree that that's an area that could bring some change, but I think we also have to look at how we can include the voices of a wider range of people in executive pay setting and getting workers on remuneration committees and getting an another voice that brings a dose of reality into the boardroom is one way that we know from other countries you can actually stop this pay escalating away at the top, where rewards are clearly no longer linked to any form of productivity gains, and try and compress pay distributions in a fairer way. Another issue that you could take up is transparency. If companies had to publish more information on the pay ratios between their top execs and those in the middle and those on the lowest incomes, it might give them more of an incentive to compress those distributions more. We also have to look clearly at the role of trade unions. We know from the IMF, who have also published research on the back of the crash, that actually if you have stronger collective bargaining, if you have a stronger role for social partners in wage setting, that is one of the most significant factors in leading to rising real wages and better pay for those at the bottom. The IMF don't just say that that's a beneficial fact for workers. They note that it has benefits for the whole economy because it brings that stability that Dean was talking about. It makes debt bubbles less likely, and it means people can afford to consume and that our growth is broader based instead of all being dependent upon one small sector of the economy as it was in the years up to the crash.
We don't have anyone here representing the business side of things. If there were, what they'd say is we've been through a big recession, and precisely because the UK has fairly shriveled trade unions these days and fairly light touch regulation, we've lost 6% of national output, but the employment rate's only dropped by 2%. So we've not seen the output cash in and as many lost jobs as we might have expected. And I imagine they'd warn that if we went down the sort of route you're suggesting, then we'd end up with higher unemployment before long.
I don't think there's any evidence at all that small re-regulation of the UK economy and a stronger role for unions across some of the lower paid sectors of the economy would lead to job loss. The key determinant of whether you have job loss in the economy is the amount of demand we have in the economy at the moment. We saw in the 10 years in the roll-up to the recession very strong employment growth in the UK, particularly in lower paid sectors. That was with the introduction of the minimum wage, which particularly in its early years was seeing quite significant increases on an annual basis. There was no evidence that it led to job loss.
Dean, you might not be steeped in the UK detail, but the Prime Minister is talking about getting rid of housing benefit for under 25s, about maybe breaking the link with inflation for some unemployed people in the benefit that they get, and also reining in some of the tax credits that top up low wages. And it's that last one I was just going to ask you about, in-work credits from the government. Do you know anything about what they tend to do to inequality and unemployment around the world?
Well, it's ironic, actually. In the US, you know, we made a big point of expanding our program, the Earned Income Tax Credit, that was expanded under President Clinton. Actually had some bipartisan support. The program actually originated with the Republican, Richard Nixon, and it actually increases incentive to work. So it's sort of ironic if your prime minister is saying, you know, he wants to give people more incentive to work. Well, that's exactly what that sort of tax credit does. So that's had, for the most part, there's been a lot of analysis. Most people would say it's a pretty positive effect in the United States. So I think as a general rule, obviously you're giving people at the lower end more money, and it does exactly what you want in the sense that you're giving it to them for working. So I would think that's what a conservative in principle would like to see.
Okay, so lots of suggestions there, even if our panel don't much like the answers from David Cameron. So thank you to Dean and to Nicola.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. Next time we'll be back in the confines of the studio as normal. But my thanks to all my guests down at the TUC. The producers were Phil Maynard and Elliot Smith. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.